Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Natalie Y. Moore discusses her play The Billboard with J. Nicole Brooks. As a play and a book, The Billboard is a cultural force that treats abortion as more than pro-life or pro-choice. The following conversation originally took place at the American Writers Festival on May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live.
Welcome to the Millennium Park Partner Stage at the American Writers Festival. I'm Linda Dunleavy, Director of Development at the American Writers Museum, and I'm delighted to introduce our next program, sponsored by the Black Arts Consortium. This program is presented in conjunction with the museum's upcoming exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. This initiative examines the enduring relevance of works by black writers during the 100-year period between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. We've curated this project with a team of extraordinary writers and artists, and a member of that team is here today to talk to us about her new play, The Billboard, about a black woman's clinic in Inglewood and the lives of those engaged in the struggle for reproductive rights. Natalie Y. Moore is an award-winning journalist based in Chicago whose reporting tackles race, housing, economic development, food injustice, and violence. Natalie's acclaimed book, The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation, received the 2016 Chicago Review of Books Award for Nonfiction and was BuzzFeed's Best Nonfiction Book of 2016. She's here in conversation with J. Nicole Brooks, actor, writer, and director. She is a multi-award-winning artist honored by 3Arts, TCG Fox Foundation, National Endowment for the Arts, Black Ensemble, Theater Playwright of the Year, LA Ovation, and Black Theater Alliance. She is an ensemble member of Looking Glass Theater Company. Welcome to you both.
Peace, everybody. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Excellent. I am so honored to be in conversation with a writer that I greatly admire, and I'm lucky enough in real life to consider Natalie my good friend. And so this is, you will have to pardon me in the moments that I fangirl swirl out, okay? I'd love to start this conversation by asking, why does this story need to be told?
So this story, I started working on this well before 2022 and well before where we are right now. When I saw the billboard in 2018, so there was an anti-abortion billboard targeting black women in Dallas. And then a Black Women's Health Center in Dallas put up their own billboard that said, among other things, that abortion is self-care. The anti-abortion billboard was part of a movement by a black man who had been doing this around the country, including in Chicago, and I had covered that story back then for WBEZ. But the self-care billboard made me uncomfortable. Of course, now I'm like, what's the big deal? But at the time, like that, you know, 2018, people weren't talking.
Can you describe what that discomfort was for you?
I didn't know. And so this was, I mean, I think art pushes people to ask questions. I'm a product of the 90s where it was keep abortion safe, legal, and rare. And so you look back and you think rare was stigmatizing, even though I don't think that was I don't think it was purposeful, but we have space and time to consider language. And I just hadn't heard self-care because self-care is very materialistic and capitalistic. It's, oh, I'm going to a spa, and I love going to the spa, but is that really like the self-care that people need? And then the women on the billboard were laughing and smiling. So I used that opportunity to push myself, which meant reading and learning more about what reproductive justice is. And I think the story needed to be told because I do think in general there's an uncomfortability about abortion and talking about it, even if you are for abortion rights. And there's some sub-threads in the in the play too, where I wanted to take on patriarchy in the Black community. Mm-hmm. And here's someone who put up this billboard who, you know, is a Black nationalist and he's all pro-Black, except when it comes to aspects of Black womanhood. And I thought this was a good way to address that through the billboard. And then it's set in Inglewood, which also has a layer of who gets to speak for community, who gets to represent community.
I have to say that I was driving northbound on State Street just a couple of weeks ago, right just past DuSable High School, and I saw a billboard, and it was an anti-abortion billboard. I know.
This is recently?
Okay. If I were not driving, I wanted to text you, like, sis, have you seen? Yeah, it's northbound, and it's State Street is a sort of a, I drive it all the time, and I passed that billboard, and I immediately thought of you. And I just thought about this work that is going to be a stage play production, but it's already having such an impact. So I would love to know why this as a stage play, as opposed to something fictional or non-fictional. Talk to us about that, please.
Yeah, because I don't think I can write a novel. I don't think that's in my wheelhouse. I don't think I have the skill set for it. I love theater, and sometimes I was actually working on another play at first, and there's something about, sometimes the story just speaks to you and you figure out what medium that is. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to try a play. I want to try something different. And I took a class at Chicago Dramatists, so I wouldn't be arrogant enough to think that I could do this without any help. And what I learned from that class is how the similarities between audio feature writing and public media is very similar to playwriting. Even the NPR handbook will say, think of your scripts as a three-act play.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I'm honored to be in conversation with Nikki, and I couldn't have done this without her, because I would call, because you know, you feel embarrassed calling your friend, like, I want to do a play, and this is what she does. It's like, girl, who are you? But she,
no.
She did not have that reaction. She
no,
was so
not at
supportive.
All.
And, you know, helped me think through all these things, which was great. But the similarities are that you're writing for the ear. And so even in my BEZ work, if I'm writing a script, the piece of tape that I use, it may not be the best thing someone said, but it's the best way that they said it.
Mm.
And when you're writing, we're told, well, don't quote people if it's informational, because that seems like a throwaway quote. But that is that those aren't the same rules in audio, because you're more on a journey and people mm-hmm. are explaining things to you. And, you know, my first drafts, it was like chunks and chunks of text. And then, you know, you remember people talk back and forth to each other, and that had to be pared down. But I don't want to say this was so easy, but I had the building blocks to transition to this form of writing.
I have to agree with you. They are very similar. I had the experience of, so you were saying, like, you called me and was like, oh gosh, because you cannot tell me I am not an NPR host. Like, you can't tell me, but, like, in my head, I'm like, I have several shows, you know? So, but I think it is because our work in so many ways, it's a three-act structure. And I know I myself, when I adapted a stage play into an audio play, it was what you just said. It was like, woo, this is a great opportunity. But on the radio, they can't listen to a half-a-page monologue. You know, yeah. Whereas theatrically in the theater, it might be a different sort of experience, but you have to keep in mind that the audioscape has to keep the listener engaged, and it's no different from when you are in a live theater. So when you took your playwriting class at Chicago Dramatists, and Did you feel at the end of that course like, okay, I got the tools, I got it, I'm out the door?
So I had established a relationship with 16th Street Theater. And as I mentioned, there was another play that I wanted to develop. But we had a homework assignment. So I mean, you're going to know this, but here's a little trick for, or a little insight for those of you who love theater. I guess another similarity. There's urgency. Like with a novel, you can meander and you can explore a topic. In a play, it is urgent. So think about the last play you saw or plays that you love. Something or someone is showing up in that moment. So your last play, Her Honor, about Jane Byrne. Jane Byrne shows up at Cabrini. I think the last play I saw was Gem of the Ocean. You know, I can't remember if he was enslaved and ran. The guy shows up on the doorstep. So there's always, it's not like, oh, we're just going to talk about or explore family dynamic. No, something, the immediacy. And that's another similarity in my own script writing. It's the stakes are high. Mm-hmm. What's here? So we had a homework assignment to write a four-pager about something, about an object.
Mm.
And so that's when I wrote a scene from the billboard. And it was very well received in the class. And then I sent it to the then artistic director of 16th Street, like, hey, I think I know what I'm doing. Here was my homework assignment. And she read it. And she's like, well, I don't want to tell you what to do, but I think this is your play instead. And I didn't have to hear anything. I didn't like, oh, but I really, I was like, okay, I will do that. I will, mm-hmm. I will pivot.
So what is the sense of immediacy, would you say, that jumps off billboard in this particular story?
The anti-abortion billboard mm-hmm. is there right away. And mm-hmm. then the counter billboard shows up.
So these two forces show up. And then you have these characters. Can you talk to me about, so you got some characters in here, my friend. Can you talk to us about how they showed up to you and the frequency mm-hmm. of it? You've done all this research, yeah? And you've done all of these, you have all of this information, but how did this particular ensemble, how did they show up?
Well, one of the things I did, and this is, I think, very specific to Black people from Chicago. I spent a lot of time thinking about what high school all these characters went to. It never shows up on the page. Shout out to two Morgan Park alum in the audience.
Can I just say, that is the most real thing ever. When you meet someone out in the world and they say they're from Chicago, and then that's the first question.
They ask what high school.
What high school did you go to?
You know, for parts of white Chicago, it's what parish did you grow up in?
Mm.
But you're orienting someone by geography, by class, by intellect, rightly or wrongly.
Absolutely.
And so that helped me, like, knowing those things helped with the character development for the five characters. Again, I would love Chicagoans afterwards to guess which high schools they think I fit.
I was just about to say, can we go through and I want to know, like, I want to know where Demetrius went to school for, like, I'd love
He to. Either, I know this is bad, he either went to Harper or Hubbard.
Okay.
I forgot which one I picked. I don't mean to say that they're the same school, but they're different at that time in the 80s from Inglewood or Robeson, I mm-hmm. thought. The city council member went to CBS.
Okay.
I think she was there with Bernie Mac, again, in my head. And then Tanya, who's from Inglewood, went to Lane Tech, so she left the community, and Demetrius feels a certain kind of way about, oh, but you didn't, even though she moved back. And then Kayla, the 19-year-old, went to Robeson. So, but you know, I mean, as you write, like you write these massive character sketches that never show up. Like, when does this person lie? Like, they're exercises that you do. So you get to intimately know your character.
Do you ever do some sort of biography for the character before you start to,
I think I had started writing just simply because I had the assignment, and then I took a step back and mm-hmm. thought and started answering questions about them.
What was the journey for you in advocating for each of your characters?
Advocating for who?
Every single one of them. As a writer, you know how you have to just, I believe you have to advocate for them, no matter what their point of view is, just so that you can get a fully fleshed out story. Even if you, the writer, might disagree with how they operate or what their politics are, what was it like?
It's always, I don't know if you deal with this, but you have to resist the urge of writing someone the way that you would respond to a situation. So I think you try to create characters who are just so different that you don't fall into that trap. So I kept thinking about that. Demetrius was interesting. I didn't base anyone on one particular character, but I have seen Demetrius types in reporting. They're kind of like the pro-blackers who might have voted for Trump, because not for religious reasons, but oh well, he's different. Oh well, the Democrats did all this to us. Oh, but I'm Black Power. And I've seen guys show up to protest development. I've seen the provocateur nature. But I didn't, it was great because during the workshop and people were like, but he said some good, like people didn't, I mean, I think he's the biggest jive turkey. I don't even know if he believes, I don't even know if he really cares about abortion. He found a way to get into the public discourse in a way that he's been able to. So there are points where he's talking about segregation and disinvestment in the community. But he doesn't know how to do it. But he can talk a good game, like, "Oh, I'm only going to let Black-owned businesses open in Inglewood." That's not how any of this works. but people can say, "But he's advocating for us to have our own," which I understand that. So I can't stand him. And then during the table read, so one of my favorite actors in Chicago read for him 2 or 3 times. And I underestimated what it's like to see actors read your words. And so if anyone goes to Steppenwolf, James Vincent Meredith read for Demetrius, I thought I was going to weep the first time he did it. Like, he's not even acting. Like, he's just at a table read. And it was what I imagined for Demetrius and then some. Unfortunately, he's on Broadway and he couldn't be in the show.
He's very famous, very fancy, and he's very generous.
And he's so, like, he didn't know me, and he loved the, I mean, he was committed to it.
And I know that feeling. I, too, have, James Vincent Meredith is a terrific actor, and he understands the new play process, and so he's able to offer things to the playwright, and he can be a very helpful person. But the tricky thing about when actors are really good, sometimes you don't, they're reading the phone book and you're like, this is prolific. I am going to get the Peabody, the Pulitzer, it's going to be great. And then someone else reads it or the dust settles and you're like, oh, there's work to be done. But so did it leave you, what was the table work and the workshop process like?
So we did, and that's another similarity to some of the, like, there's this process called, well, it's the Ira Glass, this American Life approach. It's called a group edit. So for the longer pieces, it's almost like a table read. It's a group edit. I don't really love group edits because you get 4 different people who have 4 different opinions, and then what do you do with it? And ultimately, it lies with me and my editor. But for the longer pieces, I do. For the shorter ones, I'm like, I don't need all that extra noise. Some people love them for everything. I love them for anything that's going to be like 6 minutes and above, and I find them, and you have to find the right people. Like, I can't have people who don't have any racial literacy in my, because they would ask, and I'm like, oh, this is not helpful at all. No, I'm never asking you back. So when I started writing, I was like, who's the editor? There's no editor here? I was like, there's no editor.
Did you work with a dramaturg?
So that came later. So when I had a third done of the play, we did a table read. Okay. And this is how a theater invests in you. Then it was 2/3 done. And then when that very first draft was done, and I'm getting feedback, and I can do what it is that I want with it. But it was helped. I'm like, oh, you should do a debate scene. Oh, that's a great idea. I think I'll... Like, that was a piece of advice that I...
That you got out of the mm-hmm. table reading?
Where I added something. But in general, just hearing people's responses, like, that was helpful. And then, you know, it was more rewriting. I know, like, Nami Moon, the writer, teaches playwriting also at Northwestern. She read, like, we had a long phone call about things. So it went through the process. And then Teron Patton came on as director. And then I said, I want a dramaturg, because I, in a secret another life, I want to be a dramaturg after. And I didn't realize that there were, the dramaturgs do two different types of things. So that a dramaturg, let me tell you what I wanted to be once. I thought this would be a great job for a journalist. I was watching The Color Purple here. This was many years ago. And to describe Shug Avery, they kept using the word ho. And I was like, that wasn't a word back then. They would have said whore. So that bugged me. And then there was a scene in the 1930s where, I know I've told you this story. Where
no, it's, I haven't, it's where, so good.
Where Shug and Celia are sitting on the porch in rural Georgia eating Chinese food out of Chinese boxes. Talking about this Chinese food is so good. You can't get Chinese food in rural Georgia. So I was like, I need to be a dramaturg because they need...
It's
somebody
true.
To do research. So they work with the director to make sure that things are timely, you know.
Yes.
But then there's a literary dramaturg who becomes the editor. And I was like, oh, you know I've, like, written this five times. And then she's asking questions. And I was like, but I thought I was done. I thought this week-long workshop was just perfunctory. Although Teron and Kamisha Khan, the dramaturg, they said they've never seen anybody rewrite as fast as me.
Wow.
Because I would just do it that night. And it was, it wasn't restructuring. It was, I'll give an example of something small. Well, some of the big things were like, if this person is saying this on page 50, you need to establish why they're saying, like, you have to make these connections.
Yes.
Or I think Tanya might have been coming off as maybe too unlikable, which is, I think I was a little surprised at, because that's not how I was trying to write her. But they said, you need to make her, because she's a doctor and she's the founder and executive director of this clinic. You need to make her more indispensable to the community. So it was just a few lines, like where Kayla comes in and says, Mr. Jones wants you to speak at his career day. Miss Pratt won't take her diabetes medication unless you call her. Like it was just three lines just to show that this place means something. So it was that kind of tweaking, and I would just stay up that night and do those rewrites, because I'm a journalist. Like, you have to rewrite and you're on deadline. I was like, this is not going to language. I want this on stage.
But it's that perfect blend of the dramaturgy. So, like what you cited with The Color Purple as a example, think glaring things like that happen all the time. I can remember years ago, I went to a reading for someone that did a gorgeous script, but it was set in South Africa, and there was a scene in which the setting was in a basement. Now, this was an American writing the play, so someone in the room who happened to have spent time in South Africa said that actually would not be the case. They would not have a basement. So when you're writing, it can be so crucial, especially for a new work, to have that dramaturg to help you with that, but then also when it comes to a new work, the dramaturg is helping you shape it. And you were also writing this knowing that there was a production. Is that so, or were you like, at what point?
So the production was first, Haymarket was second.
Okay.
Kevin Koval, who was curating at the time the Breakbeat series, I ran into him. He's like, oh, what are you working on? Told him. He's like, oh, can I see it? And he's like, oh, this, we should publish this. And then Haymarket thought that it read like a cultural piece. And so that came after the commitment from the theater. And then I got support from the National New Play Network, which is based in D.C. You know, they, you know, were giving money to new plays being developed. So the other tricky thing was, so now we're done, like, we're signed off, like, we are done. And then that version goes to Haymarket.
Right.
And then one of their editors, I was like, oh, no, 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 no.
We're not making it.
But
anymore.
I did ask the national, because we would have these cohorts, and I was like, you know, I want to tell them I don't want to make these changes. And they're like, you can put boundaries up. Because the director was invested in developing this as a new work, as well as the dramaturg. And so, you know, there were some questions in there. And, I mean, of course, this editor's doing their job, so they think that they're supposed to. But I'm like, no, this is different. No, no, no. There's going to be no more rewriting.
And was your director a big part of all of the writing process, or was Tehran?
At the end, with that last, with the intense workshop, so the intense workshop was a week long on Zoom, where we would do scenes and then talk about. So it was deeper than those previous table reads. It was the intense, which is why I thought, oh, this is like, we're just wrapping things up because we've already done all this other work. But that was when she was, and she had read the script already, but that's when she got involved and the dramaturg and, yeah, did.
How did you know Tehran Patton was your director?
I just love her work, and I thought that she would be great, and I was right.
Yes.
So it was.
She's a genius actor, and now she's running a museum. You know, she's just doing.
And I loved that she was an, you know, she's an actor and she's a director and she's an administrator. So even like the nonprofit stuff, she was like, the board's gonna have to approve this billboard. You got to write that in. I was kind of like, does an audience really need to know that? I mean, I didn't disagree with
sure.
it, but she was like, Tanya cannot do this on her own. And I said, okay, I'll write. I mean, again, it's one line,
sure.
but you want to put the accuracy in. And I spent a lot of time building a budget for this center that doesn't show up on the page. But I didn't want someone, most people aren't going to notice that, but I didn't want someone to come in and say, that is so unrealistic. But it's like, abortion is a cash business. And so why do they have a fundraising goal?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's the clinic part, and then here's the nonprofit. So all those things I had to work out. And then I have a friend who works at a clinic in Memphis. They do everything with reproductive needs. And she's the one who's like, abortion is cash. Like, clinics have, because most places, Medicaid doesn't
cover.
Yeah. Now, in Illinois, that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
We're one of the few states where that does happen. But just knowing, oh, there's a bubble law in Chicago. You can't protest within this amount of feet at a clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And as the play kept going, I realized, so by this year, or by December, by the time Dobbs versus the Dobbs-Jackson case went to the Supreme Court, I was like, oh, it's not if Roe was overturned, it's when, and it's going to, because the play was delayed because of COVID, it was supposed to be last year, last fall, now it's the summer, and I was like, oh, it will be overturned when this play is being staged. And then 2 weeks ago happened, which no one saw because that's never happened, a leak of a draft decision.
I really am astounded at the timing of it all. Like, no matter when this play would have received its premiere, the timing would have been right. But particularly right now, I have to say, I'm still gobsmacked by where we are. Every time I just think about it, I'm like, what is this? Why is the play set in Chicago? Why not Memphis? Why not other places in which I know something like this could very well happen? Did it have to be here for you?
Yes, because I don't know this other place. In Chicago is my muse, you know. Anybody who knows me, then I'm Chicago over everything.
Yes.
So, and I also thought it would... How does this play in a northern city? In a, because again, the uncomfortability and the backlash came from the self-care billboard. When the anti-abortion billboard came up in Chicago in 2011, it didn't really have an effect, or at least visible. Like, people denounced it. The reproductive justice community was outraged by it, but it didn't inspire this new movement of things happening. But like in Dallas, and this isn't a retelling of Dallas because I don't know those, like I wasn't trying to do that as more of an inspiration. Seeing the social, and there's a large social media component to the billboard, the play the billboard. Mm-hmm. And so looking at the reaction in Dallas, it was, again, even people who were on the side of abortion, it was like, whoa. And even though I said I was uncomfortable, I wasn't going out talking about, like it wasn't something that I felt more like, well, let me understand rather than lambasting it or trying to make an issue out of it. And I really think that they were just maybe a little bit ahead of their time in doing that. 2018 is much different saying it then than it, I think it is in 2022. Not that yes. I don't think that people still might bristle, but I think that they were really jumping out. And then there were people who felt, you know, within those communities, maybe this isn't the right time. Like, we get it, but is this undermining mm-hmm. our work or the movement? Is this the right thing to say at this time?
You've also included the voice of young people. And in American theater, we don't always hear from young Black femmes. I'd love you to talk about what some of those inspirations were.
Well, one thing that Taran told me that attracted her to the play, it wasn't so much the abortion story as it was seeing the depiction of professional Black women on stage in charge, leading, and never seeing that. And I don't know if Imani Perry snuck out. She was so gracious to write a wonderful foreword to this, where she compared it to Lorraine Hansberry. I almost fell out when she said that. I was like, what? And she said that this is a story that has professional women, but it's not a bourgeoisie story. And when I was thinking about Kayla, I think I wanted to round that out. And I was also thinking about Black girl magic, Black excellence, and how those terms can sometimes mean a certain thing. Like you have natural hair, you have a certain politics, or you're going to college, or those type of things. Like yes. it's still, you know, and I wanted mm-hmm. to highlight for lack of a better, you know, term, Around the Way girl. Like, here's a girl from Inglewood who has something to offer.
Yes.
And she's smart. And it's been really surprising that she has become, for people who've read it, the fan favorite. People love Kayla.
Yeah. Duh. Like, she's... Yeah.
And one really... of the things that Taran and Kamisha talked about was that she needed to be rewarded in the play by the end. So the thing that happens with her at the end was not in my first draft.
Oh, it wasn't
draft.
In the first draft? Mm-hmm. Was that something you discovered at the table readings?
They were like, they didn't tell me what to do. They were just like, she has to be rewarded.
Yeah.
And so I thought about what that meant, because she was the steady voice throughout. And yeah, I'm so happy that she's, because you don't know how people are going to receive. Like,
sure.
I knew what I was thinking, but I didn't write her thinking she's going to be the fan favorite. Oh, I want people to love her the most.
Sure.
I don't think you have to think about that with any of your characters. I think you just have to write. Otherwise,
Absolutely.
You get caught up in trying to think what the audience will.
Yes.
And so that has been a surprise. And then the other beautiful thing is that my stepdaughter did a lot of the table reads. And she got casted. And this is not nepotism, because Taran would not do that. And I was gobsmacked when Milan sent me the screenshot text saying she'd been offered the part. I was like, what?
Oh, my goodness.
I thought they were being nice by letting her audition.
she earned it.
Yeah, and she, I guess, can talk the social media. Like, she's lived with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was...
I'm so excited to see the production, and I just have to say that I can remember when I was younger and discovering where Lorraine Hansberry, where she lived, what high school she went to, and that was where I was from. Your work is going to do the same for so many young people. Mm-hmm. They are going to read this book and go, wait a minute, I know where that is, I know what that means, and that right there, woo, I'm like getting a little, like, it's going to save so many lives and just inspire so many people. So I just want to say, yeah. Oh,
thank you.
So, I would love to open this up to the community. Let us hear about what's on your mind. We have a microphone going around here. Microphone check, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Hey, Natalie. Thanks again for taking the time to speak about this. I was really interested in what you were talking about with character development, and I think that piece about knowing which high school the characters went to is really interesting. But I'm wondering what other writing exercises you do so that you don't fall into, I guess, like kind of the Aaron Sorkin trap of like all the characters sounding exactly the same, because they're all coming from your brain. So how do you make sure not only their character is different, but their patterns of speech might be different, but are still honest, if that makes sense?
One of the exercises is you just answer these series of questions. On what occasion does your character lie? Who is this character closest to in their life? Just a whole bunch of questions. And so that helps you with your imagination and thinking about them. So that was a pretty useful exercise. So dialogue. I guess some writers like to be holed up. I don't. Like, I have to be out in the world. And most writers don't have that cabin in the woods anyway to do that.
No.
And I remember, I really think it's my reporting. I think being out on a regular basis and interviewing people and hearing people. Yeah. And August Wilson once said that he just would sit in cafes and listen to people
talk. That's the best part of writing. Yep.
And I don't do that per se, but I think just being out in the community, and I'll never forget, there is this, when Growing Home, an urban ag endeavor in Englewood opened, there was a black man who showed up with a bullhorn. And he was like, this isn't for us, and went on. And then I remember somebody in the background, and this is like where good audio comes in, and somebody in the background said, what about him? He's black. And there were black people all around. And so that person is one of the provocateur types around. And these are, you know, not folks that you would see unless you're in communities. You know, I'll tell Evan afterwards who some of these guys, he's going to know who they are, who just kind of show up. So, or, you know, being at public, covering public meetings, being...
you do a lot of that.
Yeah,
listening.
So being... Yeah. I have to hear people, and then I hear their... I have their tape. So I would say that really helped me probably more than any... or just as much as the writing character sketches, that I know the cadence, I know how different people feel on issues and how they talk.
Right here.
Thank you so much. The two of you talk, I can listen to the two of you talk all day, and I want to thank you for the opportunity. But I wanted to ask, Natalie, the session before this one was about book banning and censorship. And I know that there is a connection between, I think, what we're seeing replay itself in terms of the McCarthy era and the banning of books, and what is happening right now, the conversation about really taking away freedom of choice for women. And I just want to hear you, because I think what I enjoy about your work is you are a journalist, but you're also a historian. So can you connect in your mind, if you can, maybe why these two things are happening at the same time?
It's about control. I think that's the simplest way. But, you know, I mentioned that there's the things that made me uncomfortable, but that didn't mean that I just paused and thought about why. Like, we have to do self-interrogation. So for people who want to ban books, I mean, some of this is just really orchestrated from, I forgot the man's name. Like, there's a man who was orchestrating CRT backlash, and next up is social emotional learning, which goodness. Anybody who has small children knows that this is wonderful that they have in schools. But I try to think about what are, you know, the people who aren't demagogues, like why do they, what is fueling them? And I think it's the feeling of being marginalized, that uncomfortability, the differences, and not understanding that books can help you expand and understand these things rather than pushing them out. And banned, so this is Tracy Hall from the American Library Association. And we are hearing an uptick now, but this has always been happening. And I learned that one of my books is banned in prisons, the Blackstone book.
Oh, yes, that's right, that's right.
And so when I found out because this is when the new Jim Crow was banned in New Jersey, and then my friend was like, you know your book's on here too. And then that prompted me to FOIA, the Illinois Department of Corrections, to get their whole banned list. And we put it all on the website as a document. I mean, there are a lot of things like porn that were on there and, you know, things that I guess I could understand, although one person said, well, maybe you want them to have an outlet rather than having an outlet a different way in the prisons. But they're like, you know, copies of XXL magazine. I mean, the only thing that I think maybe should be banned is, you know, how to build a bomb.
I was just thinking, I was like, how to build a bomb. Yeah.
But everything else, and it's so whimsical, like how they decide. But when I've gone into prisons, every time they're like, oh yeah, I read that. Somebody's smuggling my book in, or there's Xeroxing copies.
More power to them.
So, I mean, I think it's like on one hand, it's just extreme control driven by white supremacy. But what about the folks who I think maybe could change? Maybe I'm being too optimistic to think that some of these parents at some school districts can change. And I think that they just feel like they're being guilted into whiteness somehow. And or that their children are going to be made to feel guilty.
I cannot wrap my mind around it.
And I don't think that that's not where people are going with these books. And if that's your feeling, I think you have to work that out yourself. But ultimately, all of this is about some form of control.
Natalie, as an ordinary citizen, sometimes we struggle with how can we possibly change public policy that we don't agree with. And I had an experience on Friday. I went to see a performance of Teatro Vista. It's a Latino theater company. Teatro Vista's new production, Somewhere Over the Border.
Yes.
I was so deeply emotionally moved by the play, by the musical, and it made me think that perhaps art is a more powerful way to move the needle on public policy than news media or protests or anything else we can do as citizens. And I don't know if you wrote the play with that in mind, but I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on the power of art to really help us change public policies that we don't agree with.
I think all these things work in tandem, and journalism is powerful, but yes, I do think art is there to disturb, to make uncomfortable, to challenge. I think art can be a more accessible way to get your feet wet into some of these issues and to understand. And there's so many great examples of folks doing that work in Chicago. We have so many amazing artists like Nikki, visual artists. I mean, Chicago is wonderful in that way. So I do think that it can be maybe a little less intimidating, because there may be people who see my play, they may feel like that. I think most viewpoints are represented, and they may see themselves in it, or they may just enjoy it, and because they like going to the theater, and the issues may not resonate with them, but maybe afterwards it does, or it gives them something to think about. But absolutely, I think art is that tool.
I was kind of wondering, when was there a time in history
when abortion wasn't controversial, A, and then B, what do you think that art would have to do with it?
What art has to do with it? Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say there's a really, really good book about the history of Roe. It's called The Family Roe, R-O-E. And it was a finalist for the Pulitzer last week. And it gives you, and here's the most fascinating history. Well, I knew, so in the 70s, abortion was not politicized. There were pro-choice Republicans.
Yes.
And pro-life Democrats.
Yep.
There was a woman, I forgot her last, Mildred, a black woman, and this book details her. There was a black woman who became the first black woman to graduate from Harvard Medical School. And because of racism and sexism, she could not be a surgeon, but never saw herself as a victim of racism or sexism. And she ended up becoming president of a Right to Life group. And she got on Ronald Reagan's radar. And he said that she wow. changed his mind on abortion. And that, so the author lays, wow. like this is the pivotal moment where abortion became politicized, was this woman.
I did not know this.
I don't think most people, I don't think anybody does really, unless they are like really steeped in this work.
Oh
so
gosh.
I'm not saying that it wasn't controversial because it was banned, but it wasn't politicized. And that politicization meant, I mean, this is what we have lived through.
Thank you so much,
Thank
everyone.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, historian and author Deborah Cohen discusses her book, Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.